Hey there, Shopping Manx. You're listening to another Hard Stop edition of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave in the shed. Rupert with me is Chris in the office. Square. Hey, Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks, Dave. Happy and healthy.
2024.
Another day in the office. Yeah. Mid-March here, waiting for it to warm up and stuff. You know, we thought we'd just do a bunch of questions. Because they build up over a while, and really appreciate everybody that sends them in, and we pick out some of our favorites that are applicable to things going on, and we're just going to do it. So I'll read the first one, and you can read the next one, and there we go. Chris Colvin writes in, "Hey dudes, we are dudes. Thanks, Chris. I recently asked a question on r front end subreddit, which I recently learned has a Discord too. That's interesting that popular subreddits have Discords, or at least web dev does, our web dev, about a WordPress developer position I'm interviewing for. And I was surprised how vehemently people there seem to argue against taking a WordPress centered position. Some went so far to say that including WordPress on your resume as a front end is a career killer. I was surprised by this with the prevalence of WordPress on the internet and wondered, is there some truth to this, or is just a few slightly elitist framework fans on Reddit? Thanks." Yeah, I don't know that Reddit is like emblematic of the entire industry. You know, people are just tend to be able to have some opinions on that their website, just like the old Hacker News and stuff. I would agree that WordPress is real polarizing sometimes. And I would not be surprised if there was somebody in a hiring position who's just, you know, had this career and they just happen to be one of those types of developers that just freaking hate WordPress. I've met lots of them in my time. And somebody has an interview with them. They see WordPress and they're just like, bleh, and they don't hire you. And I could see that happening easily. I think that's ridiculous, but
that's so disgusting. It's like, but it's the truth. Is there's this these weird biases. It's like you say something wrong and people would be like, "You said it, not good. You said WordPress, you're out." You know, like, I don't know. I think it's dumb. I think Reddit also is going to be like, new tech is the best tech. You know, like whatever's hot, what's hot. Literally, the website has hot. You know, it has a hot button. So like, it's always going to err towards like what's hot. So you got to temper that. I don't know. I would love to know your thoughts, Chris, because I'm behind the modern WordPress development sort of thing, but the curve. But I do think there is an argument to be had that if you are doing WordPress, you are probably in a totally different environment than most tech companies. Does that make sense? Like if I'm working in WordPress, I've usually got like a LAMP stack server, local. Yeah. I'm not really NPM installing stuff. I'm not bundling stuff. I'm not, you know, I'm not dev. I'm not doing this. I'm just like kind of living my life in PHP land and very light theming. I'm not getting into the whole like CSS and JS, Webpack, React, Rube Goldberg machine.
Yeah, unless you are.
Unless you want to.
You know, yeah. Unless you're, you know, I was listening to a front end happy hour where they had, I think, Jason Ball on. We've had him on this show before too, talking about his WP GraphQL plugin. Every person that's ever installed that plugin is building something that's in NPM, you know, JavaScript-y land. So whatever that number is, and that's just one plugin, right? So, but I do tend to agree with you. You know, the WordPress sites I generally build don't do that, you know? Although it's changing a little bit because my muscle memory for wanting that stuff is, you know, the last WordPress site I worked on, I jammed Vite into it because I was like, God dang it, I want something to process my crap. And Vite is relatively simple to just be like, okay, I just need like, you know, my JavaScript bundled up and CSS bundled up. And it just was able to do that with a little watcher server pretty easily. So I did that. And then I even did the little VS Code thing that whenever I open that folder, it runs a command. And that command is npm run dev. And npm run dev is Veet Watch or whatever it is. So it's just like, I don't even think about it. You know, you open that folder, Veet's doing its thing, rock and roll. And it's just, so I only mention that because that's like a little bit modern. It's like a little bit touching that, you know, kind of world that probably, you know, people that poo-poo WordPress think isn't involved anymore or whatever. And I'd say, all, you know, as a random thing, I'm a little behind the curve too. There's this concept in WordPress called full site editing that they abbreviate FSE a lot that I don't have a good bead on. Is that what they want you to do? Does WordPress have an opinion like that? You know, are they saying, hey, we want you to continue building themes, but the kind of themes we want you to build are FSE themes? Or do they not really care? Are they like, that works for some sites, but the kind of quote unquote traditional way of just a bunch of PA, they're very different in that a full site editing thing, it might just have a style.css file and then it's something called like theme or site.json or something. And it just has a bunch of like kind of design token-y stuff in it. Like for real, like that's it. You're like, oh, these are the fonts used. These are the colors and stuff. And that, so you don't have this big folder full of PHP files like you kind of normally think of as a WordPress theme. And that's important because if you're a WordPress developer, probably a lot of your time is spent in that theme folder. Just like, what's going on with this theme? Or maybe if you're really focused on plugins, that's going on. Yeah. So it is a kind of a different world. I would hope that, you know, people with their heads screwed on straight are, wouldn't poo-poo somebody just because they happen to have some WordPress experience. I mean, that's silly. I'd consider it a plus a little bit, even if you're, you know, it just means, hey, they've done some work on the internet. They've been around. They've done some things. What is it?
Well, and who cares? The twist too, right? What I'm going to in my head is like, I would actually rather you have worked on a production WordPress site that had traffic versus like you wrote infinite JavaScript on an internal app with three users, you know, like you're going to have totally different challenge sets there, you know, like you're almost greenfield, do whatever you want. No rules, no consequences on the like small use internal app, but you're like, you know, any mess up you do could like topple the PHP server, you know, in WordPress, you know? So it's, I don't know. I don't think it's a career killer. But I do think there are different types of development. I think you may want to either, if you do take this job, and I think you should, especially in this economy, but I think you should like, you know, if it's a good job and pays good and does what you want, do it, you know. But I would also maybe like look for ways that you can set up your LinkedIn or whatever to amplify the non-WordPress stuff you do, you know. And maybe that's, you have a side project. Yeah. I hate to like put that on you, but maybe that's a really great way to show that you don't just know WordPress.
Sure.
You know, I think if you, maybe you just whatever, post, you know, write a LinkedIn post about how you're taking Veet into your,
oh yeah, there you go,
into your WordPressification, you know, that could probably get you your next job, you know.
Yeah, so it just might. I think there's an element of just, hey, read the room, you know, just ask them some questions first, you know. Don't roll in there and be like, hi, my name's Jim, you know, love me some WordPress. Has this job got the WordPresses? Because I'll do that, you know, like that, you know, whatever. Just be a little more coy about it. You know, if you can sense that they're into that, then lean into it. If you can sense that whoever you're talking to has a little biased against it, then just shut up about it, you know.
Hi, my name's Mr. WordPress, and I would like to work at your company.
I've been pressing words my whole life.
Mr. Yeah. WordPress, do you know any other software? What in darnation? I do not. I only know WordPress. I would never. Yeah, yeah, that would. Mr. WordPress is a, don't be Mr. WordPress or Mrs. WordPress, but yeah.
That's all Chris wanted to know there. So I think we're good to go. You know, we got a sent in audio question here. So Chris N, slide that MP3 in there if it still resolves. Looks like it does. But it's friend of the show, Stephen Garrity, wants to know.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Chris. It's Stephen Garrity here from Prince Edward Island, Canada. And my question for you today is, what are your most and least favorite parts about building a website these days? My answer to the question would be, my least favorite parts are setting up the build process and the general tooling around that. Not because it's not important, and I love when it's done well, but it just feels like it's one step removed from actually building the website. It's probably also because I'm not great at it. My most favorite parts would probably be writing the basic CSS for some of the most fundamental elements of a site, like button styles, link styles, basic form styles, font styles, things that sometimes are global because that's what building websites used to be. Anyhow, what's your least and most favorite parts? And thanks a lot. Bye.
What are yours, Dave? Like straight up like levels of fun. Like, is there anything you still consider like, ooh, I like this part?
I like when there's a, you know, there's a pattern and there's new tech. Does that make sense? Like drop down with popover or drop down with details. You know what I mean? Like when there's a new advancement in CSS and can I like squeeze in or do the old trick with the new thing? Does that make sense? That's the stuff I kind of like. And I try to look for opportunities, you know, to mess with that sort of stuff, you know. Grid like has changed my life, but you know, it's sort of, you know, I think last week on the show we had Fred on to talk about Astro's new DB, you know, and have a project, and I was building out some big dumb YAML thing, and I was like, you know, this is probably a great use case for AstroDB, you know, like those sort of things, like where a new tech happens and it can fit kind of, and I can stop doing it the dumb way or maybe fix that. Those are still my favorite parts, I think.
That's
scroll
awesome.
Triggered animations, friggin' awesome. I only understand them half, but they're friggin' great. So,
oh my God, dude. You got to look at that API one of these days. It's so good. I'm like, I'm glad this went through some, I happen to know it went through some revisions, I think, because it was, I think there's a world where you imagine it first and you're like, okay, API, you know, the duration of this animation is just the length of the scroll. So done, you know, but they didn't, that's certainly possible, but they did much more than that. They did this thing that it ties to the current visibility of the element on the page. So like if that's all they had before, and I'm not sure if this is exactly how it went down, but you're like, let's say, you know, you're 75% scrolled down the page and that's when this little section comes in that has little blog post cards or something and you want them to, you know, pop up a little bit when they become visible. How would you do it before? You just have to be like, I don't know. I guess that's 75% scrolled. We start doing that. That's not going to cut it. That's too magic number-y. But you can say, you know, when this element becomes in view, and you can be like, it can be immediately. It can be only when it's 100% in view. It can be when it's 50% in view or 25% in view. Then make the animation apply and make it finish when it's, say, halfway up the page, or make it finish when it's 100% of the way through the page. So it's really cleverly done. Like, how long do you want that animation duration to be is like between two points on the scrolling
on a
thing.
Viewport.
Like,
yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah, no, they did a really good job with it. And, you know, I tried some things that, but you know, it gets into this like whole like math element, which I'm, you know, there are people on like the person, I forget who it was it like, I have like Scott Kellum in my head, but I don't know, but like, who did like the 3D, you know, like build a cube in CSS using like CSS perspective and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah. I think I'd like DeSandro with that, but DeSandro, that was a pretty common thing to try to do.
Yeah, I just like people who like intuitively grasp that. I'm always amazed, you know. I'm just very like, I think I get it. It's backface visibility. Ah,
I know. And then you're, then the jaw drops for the like Anna Tudor stuff and Tamani Afif and whatever, who are like, you know, making not only a cube, but a dodecahedron in 3D or something. And you're like, yeah, I'm out.
They're just it's the Tron cycle, but in CSS. And you're like, wow. Whoa. It's the animated film A Bug's Life in CSS. Mm-hmm. Wow. Amazing.
Exactly. There's these, I could go on and on because CodePen is fortunately home to some of that stuff that you see, CSS paintings by Ben Evans. And,
oh, yeah. What are your favorite parts of the web, like building and or least favorite?
I don't know. There's lots of it, solving some kind of like UX problem, thinking out four or five ways to do it, even collaboratively, is very fun to me. And then be like, ooh, yeah, that's it. You nailed it. That's the one, oh, I love it. We landed on the perfect solution kind of thing. Or like, it's better than it was, so ship that. I like that. Technology wise, no surprise probably to anybody, I really do like writing CSS. So if that becomes part of what I have to do that day, is like, I need to turn this concept or these decisions into CSS. Even just refactoring CSS is fun. There is a kind of a UI PR that came through that I was like, oh, that, just needs some work. I get it. It's all good. It was just temporary anyway. So it wasn't anybody's fault that it wasn't clean, but I'm like, I'm going to make this follow the patterns that we've already established for CSS on this site. And that was very, satisfying and fun and nice. And partially because of CSS's evolution, I'm like, oh, I see what they're trying to do here. Don't need to do that anymore. That's a two liner or a zero liner in some cases, but if something's already display grid or something, I don't know, just leave it alone or things like that. It's kind of interesting to see somebody who hasn't written CSS in a minute reach into some stuff and be like, wow, you're setting all kinds of stuff that's like in this design system. You don't even have to, if you use the select element, don't worry about setting its background and hover colors and stuff. The design system's already got it.
Yeah.
So I really like that CSS stuff these days, but I liked your answer too. I think that's fun to kind of try out new tech and see how it might potentially help you someday.
Yeah, like abusing like a range slider or something to like build like something squeezy or something like that. That's fun. It's abusive. It's probably really inaccessible, but it's fun. Interesting that there's that Safari toggle came out, but like some people would make a toggle that's like 10 pixels wide that would go from 0 to 1 and only have a step of 1. So it's like basically a binary input.
Oh, what?
Maybe a terrible idea, but like it kind of achieved, like, I don't know. That stuff's interesting. But
step
one thing I was
one on a range
step
slider.
Step one, range slider, 0 to 1 and on or off. I have a recent example of something I don't like, and it's actually, I started making a game and for the play date, the little yellow square guy.
No.
And yeah.
Really?
Playing around with that.
I got one of those.
Yeah. It's just mine somewhere. But anyway, I just wanted like a lot of limitations and this felt like it had it, but I was making it, and then I chose this like framework that gave me kind of like a Zelda style top down, you go to a room and go to another room and like, ta-da. Okay. And this is not web tech. This is in Lua. So it's a little bit out there for me. But I was I'm enjoying, I'm hacking it, the demo, kind of making it mine, like feeling out the kind of the bounds of the sort of game, and then like somehow I broke the piece where you like go up north and go to the room above the north and your guy shows up at the bottom. Like, it's like that like piece of sort of like, I don't know. That's like the whole Zelda thing is like going from room to room, And I was just like, and that's why I use this little framework thing. Cause like that was in the thing. And then I broke it somehow, or it was never working, but I swear it was working at one point. But so I broke it and I'm don't know how to fix it now, you know? So it's like going to be a whole couple day stopper to figure out how to fix that piece. And yikes, you know, like that's just a frustrating thing. And the only other like facsimile I can think of is like the Nux 2 to Nux 3 upgrade. Like that was a hard upgrade. And like, you know, Nux was like, oh, it's going to be easy. We're going to make all these tools and stuff. And it's like still a hard upgrade. I don't know people who are like, I think most people are not upgrading. They'll just rewrite the whole thing because like that's what's easiest, you know? And that's like,
oh, wow.
You know, so like this whole dependency.
Is Nux 2 still in Vue 3 though?
Nux 2 can run Vue 3, but it's in Vue 2. So, and which has been like EOL'd and all this stuff. And so like, it's a bad sitch, you know, but like, but the upgrade was super hard and like, you know, and like, you know, when you're building an app.
That sucks. I expect it to be a little chiller than that. You know, upgrades like that tend to be, they just tend not to be so hard. You know, they're like, you know, they allow more incremental crap, you know. Next is just edging with some troubles with it because they're like, you know how you use this like pages folder or whatever? Now there's an app folder too, and you can incrementally move stuff to it. And I'm like, ooh, a new folder? That's that fundamental? Oh, no, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, but Astro's been generally chill. You know, I heard a little chatter in the Discord, and fair enough that it's only, they've only been around a couple of years, and they're on what, 4.5 or 5 or something? Yeah. It's like, and I shipped a website to production at 0.8. Not that long ago. But I did upgrade it at one point and I was like, oh, I see. This is like a little different, but it took like, I don't know, an hour maybe. Mm-hmm. And there was error messaging that helped along the way. That's more in line with what I expect.
That's I wonder if like, this might be an app that somebody could build, but like a pain scale, like upgrading from like 2 to 3 of something or 4 to 5 or 0 to 4, yeah. You know, like how what bad was is the it? Pain scale, you know, like,
yeah. Hey, you want to know who wins?
Who?
WordPress. You know what happens when you ship a WordPress version update? It just works.
It works.
Any version you jump to, they don't break anything ever. And it's awesome.
Yeah, I feel like they learned their lesson. Well, and this was kind of old tech days, right? PHP, but like, you know, you're sending an update over the wire and it has to land and has to update, you know, like it pre-flights the whole update and then it commits it if it was successful, you know. That's wild. That's, you know, runs all the migrations, all that stuff. So
yeah,
incredible.
This episode of Shop Talk Show was sponsored by Jack's Radical Design Course. That's radicaldesigncourse.com/shoptalk. If you could lick a 3-pound toad and magically become an incredible designer, would you do it? I would. And what if instead of an organic wart machine, it was a rebellious video course, and instead of licking it, all you had to do is watch it and follow along? Would you do it then, fair listener? Well, this ad script that I was handed might suggest this toadless, wartless web design course by Jack McDade, the creator of Statamic, is anything but boring. It will not teach you how to copy overused trends nor surrender to the safety of so-called best practices and cookie-cutter templates. Instead, it teaches you how to develop your own personal style, how to write content that will be remembered, how to use design to stand out in a crowd, and how to design quickly and efficiently so you can get on with the 71 other things on your to-do list. Don't I know it? And I love Jack's style too. This is good cop, but he's an excellent designer too. I'm going off script, sorry. And yes, even though Jack wrote the script I'm reading to you right now, you don't have to take his or my word for it. Real customers of this course have called it exceptional, hilarious, and more life-changing than toilet paper. So if you have the itch to build new skills and create something original, check out Jack's Radical Design Course at, again, radicaldesigncourse.com/shoptalk and use the code shoptalk, all caps, to save 10%. Prior design experience not required. Burnt out designers welcome. fantastic. What do we got next, Dane?
We got a question from Dave's Blinking Cursor. I assume that's mine. would love to hear your thoughts on HTMX. Have you had a chance to try it out yet?
I have not actually tried it, although I have. I've heard plenty about it, you know?
Well, yeah, I've read the docs. I've seen it. I've even done stuff like this in the past, you know, like jQuery versions of this, you know, where I would ask Rails for like a Rails partial, and then, you know, and Rails could like spit out HTML if I said accepts HTML or whatever on the request, you know. And I would kind of do this, and that is kind of how like TurboLinks kind of worked, you know. I do think what's cool is HTMX is it's like pretty well known, I guess, you know, like, well, like if I slipped DaveMX into a project, that's a hair raising experience. If I sneak HTMX into a project, people would be like, what's this cool new thing I heard about on Reddit? You know, like that's, it has that going for it, I would say. So, I think just the like universality and distributionness of it,
that helps is good. The world,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's notably, it's not a router really. Right. Like, I don't, so the way that you build with it is pretty aligned with like the, you know, old school way of building websites. That jQuery way is not, is closer to the HTMX world than it is to Vue or React, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think like, you know, I think it's cool. I think it's great. I think it also depends on what you have set up. Like you have to have a server that can serve back HTML as a response, you know, of HTML, right?
Are you listening, everybody? You need to be basically a backend developer to use it. It's more of a backend tool because it says your API, when you hit it, you can do whatever you want. You can, it can be REST, it can be anything. It just whatever. When you hit one of those URLs though, what it wants back is HTML, not JSON. So like figure it out. Like you, there's less tools for that, I feel like. I'm almost surprised it's not more popular in WordPress because it's like WordPress REST API will give you the HTML of something like a post.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or a group of posts. That's what you need. You need a server that's returning HTML at endpoints. If you have that or are very comfortable building that, then you can take advantage of HTMX greatly. But HTMX itself does not help you with that. They're like, you need a server that can return little chunks of HTML. Do you got that? No? Then build it yourself. You know?
Yeah. So I think there's something to be said about this pattern, you know, just like you're sending requests and getting, you know, this HTML back. I think that's like kind of cool, but I also think like you have to be set up for it. And so if you're not set up for it, which I don't know many that are, or you're writing middleware to do it all, you know, that's,
yeah,
you have to write it somewhere. That's kind of the thing, you know.
I've listened to a bunch of interviews with the guy who made this thing, and you'll never hear the word hypermedia more in your life. It's just, that's what is like the fundamental kind of, call it computer science, if you will, thing behind it.
Yeah.
It's like, what, because the thought is, what if HTML did this? That's what I believe why it's called HTMX, is because it's like, in a perfect world for him or the people that really like this philosophy, HTML failed to do this stuff for us. So we're going to like augment HTML as if it had more powerful hypermedia controls. And I like projects that have a philosophy like that. They're like, we have a strong philosophy. We publish papers on this philosophy. And here's the framework that goes with that philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. And isn't the Hateos, hate OAS, hypermedia as the engine of application state. And so, you know, I don't know. I think there's something elegant as like you're sending state down as a JSON chunk and you're saying, hey, browser, here, do what you will with this JSON chunk, you know, sort of like an agnostic. But then, you know, they're just saying, take it a step further and make the server just compute that HTML that it would render. I don't hate that. I it's actually more friendly to clients, like making your iPhone. We just did that web sustainability episode, you know, making your iPhone, shipping it the JavaScript to process and stuff. And so that it can spit out a list of LIs bespoke to this page. Like that's a lot to put on a phone, you know, like times a million views, you know? So, so making the server do it is actually pretty efficient, I should say, pretty efficient. Like, so yeah, that I like about it. There is, I think, a meta discussion. I know they got like kicked off of web.dev or our web dev or something like that, the HTMX for a while.
Yeah, the even the Twitter account is very just spicy and meme-y and stuff. And it's a big turnoff for me, but like hearing the actual dude behind it talk, he's not an idiot. He's a smart guy. So I almost give him some leverage. Be like, dude, you'd have no marketing chops. You tried this, it worked. So they lean into it. I get it.
Right. I think that's kind of like probably how it happened. I do just, you know, is it talked about just because it got talked about, like a brute force attempt to make it popular? You know, is that why it's, you know, was it a social exploit that made it popular, or is it really useful for people? So I don't know. That said, I like, we were just talking about the YouTubers before the show. I know Primogen likes it, like for Go apps and stuff like that or whatever. So
I could see it. I could see it. If you're a Go dev and you're constantly making little routes and I don't know, it does seem to fit that world.
Yeah, it's almost like if you're only doing like a back-end app, you know, that serves HTML, this is like a way to go. You're not even getting into whole client-side crap, you know? Like, yeah. That's
what's the sprinkleability factor of it? Do you have a good sense of that?
Sprinkleability.
Because, you know, that was what, you know, like Lit is sprinkleable and Petite View is sprinkleable. You know, you could argue jQuery is sprinkleable. I mean, they're starting to get pretty big, but like, I've seen things that are like, oh, HTMX is really good at, for example, infinite scroll. You know, you scroll down, it makes a request, gets some more stuff, and jacks it in there. Is it worth loading HTMX just for that? Is it small enough for that? Let's see what the...
Well, it's 15K gzipped, 44K minified.
It's in that jQuery territory.
In the jQuery territory. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it could be. I think you don't want to do it everywhere, maybe. I think it's a cool tech. If I came across it in a project, like I'm saying, I would rather it, if somebody took this approach, them use HTMX so that I know what it is when I hop into a repo, you know? Like I understand, oh, that's what they're doing. You know, it's not right. A mystery to me. So,
you know, this, I wonder what kind of, this is just ignorance. So sorry, everybody, that, you know, we're doing speculation on a podcast rather than actually just knowing what's up. But you can put attributes for clicking and what you want to happen with the clicking right on whatever HTML. I'm like, is it actually whatever? Or does it limit what's going on? Like the homepage is like, look, you can put a post on a button. Buttons can't post by themselves normally. They got to be in a form, and then you click and then the form can post. Fine. Mm-hmm. But this is saying, no, I don't want to wrap it in a form. I just want to post right from the button. Seems kind of fine to me because you can already click a button. Like it already has focus state and all that stuff. Hitting return on it presumably will continue to trigger this event and stuff. So the accessibility isn't ruined here. But if it was a div and you put HX post on it, that's not good. Because you can't focus on it. So you've screwed accessibility, and the framework, in a way, isn't trying to prevent you from doing that.
Yeah, to my knowledge, it's not. I mean, yeah. So the potential for foot gunning is up there, you know. But, you know, no JavaScript helps you. React doesn't help you, you know. Like, they don't nothing helps you solve this, you know?
That's true. So why be mad at just one library for not helping you and none of them do?
Be mad at everybody all the time. That's fair enough. Secret to being a senior web developer. Well, I feel like we answered that one.
Sure. Raphael here for Ferrand is kind of wondering about PNPM. It seems like PNPM is the trendy node package manager right now. Everywhere we hear people talking about it, we only hear good stuff. Have you used it? Any reason not to jump on this train? Are the benefits worth moving to it when working on an existing project or when starting new projects? That kind of thing. Have you PNPM'd, Dave?
That sounds not safe for work. Yes, I have before. I'm not on it right now. There was something that was like, oh, it's asking a lot of me to like move over to this. It was something like I had to set up my node or something to use a feature that allowed, it's that feature that they're talking about turning on by default, you know, and then you'd have to turn off for NPM. Anyway, I'm blanking on it right now. PNPM is cool. Like, as I understand it, it installs all of your node modules, not into the project node modules folder. It installs it to a root folder, like your user folder. And so everything's kind of global. And then it's like, you know, whatever, .pnpm. And then you have a folder for React at 1.2 or React at 14, React at 15, React at 18. And then your project says, cool, I'll just get the one I already have. If this project's resolving to 18, I'm just going to grab the one from disk. And so it speeds up the whole process, right? And it also solves the like node modules black hole problem, sort of, because you just have one black hole. You don't have 1,000 black holes on your machine.
Okay. So there's no, isn't the way that node resolves modules is to like look first in the current directory, but it's happy to go up directories. But in PNPM, if there's only one directory to look at, that seems to add some like efficiency to the party.
Yeah. It's going to be like a shared repository of things on your system that it's going to go look for.
What if you only have one project? It's not that useful then? Or is it, it's most useful across multiple projects?
I think most useful across multiple, you know, if you're a company with like 10 repos, you know, I think it'd be great. You know, like if you're, you know, you have whatever, project one, project two, project three, this would be really great to like help you, you know, when people are moving faster, because chances are they've installed project one when they open project two. So when they open project two, the dependency map is, or graph is probably going to be very overlappy on the Venn diagram. So I think you're going to have faster time installing that.
I wonder if that's true for a mono repo too, then. Like, is it inherently mono repo friendly?
I think it has like mono repo features. That's part of it too, is it has this whole workspace idea, and NPM has that too. And but it has kind of a mature workspace sort of idea. I think honestly for my next project, I would consider it.
I wonder what the gotchas are though. There's got to be some, right? Is there crap that's just not compatible with it, or is it just magically 100% compatible with anything NPM can do?
I mean, I think it's pretty compatible. So the thing I was talking about was CorePack. Sorry,
I know all about
CorePack. Of course, I should have known it was CorePack. So CorePack is what you have to enable to run PNPM. And you also have to do it in later yarns. Yeah.
Right. And CorePack is a node thing.
It's a node feature, a module for node, and you have to turn it on for node.
Right. And there may be implications to that.
Node is good software. I do not know what you're talking about. But I think it was, you know, I'm looking here, like PNPM, like it wasn't really until like Node 16, 18, 20, where it like really very worked, you know? So I think I was kind of in a Node 14 project or 16 project when I'd first tried it. So it was kind of like, it should have worked, but it's just kind of beefier. I don't know.
That's kind of cool. There's even a package.json change. I'm not sure how directly related it is, but you can kind of demand which package manager a project uses from your package.json now. It's the package manager property, and then say like, you got to use PMPM for this. You know, I don't know if that's good or bad. I would say it's good at a company so that, you know, you don't have one of your six developers is just like, I like PMPM, so I'm just going to use it, you know, and you're like, well, I don't want random crap going wrong on your machine, please. You know?
Right, right. I don't think you should like YOLO this, you know. It's not because like with Yarn, you could kind of use Yarn and no one would know, you know. I think it would like create a Yarn lock or whatever, but you don't commit that, you know, but
that's, yeah. If you don't commit it though, that's, I mean, I get what you're saying, but like, that's not a good vibe. Don't do
what
that.
Do you mean? You don't have just 12 files you don't commit, like 12 ghost files.
That lock file is like pretty important across yeah. the people that work with you. Okay. Here's a little story. We use Yarn 1 at CodePen. Yarn 1 is old, whoops. But let me yeah. tell you, listener, that Yarn at one time was better than NPM. It did clever installation stuff. It was faster. It had workspaces. It could do stuff that NPM can do. Yarn 1's days are over. Just default yeah. NPM is definitely way better than Yarn 1.
Yeah.
But Yarn kept evolving. So we recently have upgraded to Yarn 4, which does use the core pack and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yarn 4 is cool. Yarn 4 has options that you can be like, I want it to behave like PMPM operates with yeah. the global cache thing. So like, if you want the spirit of PMPM, Yarn 4 can just do that if you want. It can also do it the way that NPM works. If you want it to work just like NPM, you can have it do that too. And it has this other crazy version that like bundles all your dependencies up as like little zip files or something that you commit. So like, the next person doesn't even have to install them, you know, it's just ready to rock.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a really weird way of doing stuff, but that's cool. Like it can especially be nice for something like CI where it's like, you don't even have to install because all the dependencies are just ready to use.
Yeah.
That's cool. I think
I could see that. Yeah, no, I think Yarn got better. One cool thing Yarn does too, is it like it, if you, you know, when you like install SAS and it'll like compile itself, you know, or libsass used to do that, but like new SAS, I don't, Dart SAS doesn't, but it would like compile and like add a binding. We did this with like Puppeteer, like a browser would install. NPM will like attach the architecture, the CPU architecture to that binding, to that install, and put it in the lock file. And so when you go to a server or another computer that does not fit that, it like has a full heart attack, you know? So Yarn doesn't like inject that information into its lock file. So it actually is better, you know, for cross-platform stuff. And so I think PMPM has that feature too.
There's, yeah, a lot to think about here. I would say as general advice, if you're listening to this show, we just talked about a lot of complicated stuff. What you should use is NPM. Because NPM is pretty good and it's really, really, really with the grain of Node and how things should operate. If you have a real strong reason or some legacy stuff to not use NPM and want to use Yarn or PMPM, I don't know, go ahead, I guess. Like there can be advantage, but it feels like next level stuff that it just, I would just hope that people don't have to worry about on a normal day-to-day basis. And for the most part, package managers are pretty interoperable and do a good job. So rock and roll.
Yeah. Generally, they do the same thing a little different way. So it tends to work.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, we're hitting the hard stop here, so we better power it down. Thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher church. Be sure to share our favorite out. That's how people find out about the show. Send in more questions. We love them. We love questions. And then join us over in the Discord, patreon.com/shopdocshow. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
ChapDocShow.com.